Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Harry Cliff. He's a particle physicist based at the University of Cambridge and carries out research with the LHCb experiment at CERN's Large Hadron Collider. And we're talking about his book, Space Oddities, The Mysterious Anomalies Challenging Our Understanding of the Universe. Harry, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk about this book, which I found really unique. Welcome to the show.
Well, good to be talking to you, Mark.
I don't think I've ever read a book that the main focus is anomalies. And this book, actually, there are only a few books that really sort of change the way I look at things. And this book is one of them. There's a quote that you begin the book by Isaac Asimov. The most exciting phrase to hear in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, is not Eureka, I found it. But that's funny. Expand on that, because that's what this book is about.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the history of science, we tend to think of these Eureka moments that get mythologized. I mean, I guess a classic example is the apple falling, you know, from Isaac Newton's apple tree and supposedly inspiring gravity, although that is actually a bit of a myth. But actually, that isn't really how science progresses. And a lot of the biggest breakthroughs that we've had in physics and cosmology, which is really the areas that the book focuses on, have come from little sort of niggling problems that people pick up in experiments that when they drill into them, they discover that actually this is a clue to something really, really profound. And so that was really the story I wanted to tell, to actually say the way that science progresses is not by these sort of flashes of inspiration, but actually by chasing down these funny little effects. And, you know, a good example of this, you go back to the discovery, probably the biggest discovery of the 20th century was the discovery of the radiation from the Big Bang.
And that's included in your book.
Yeah, exactly. And that began as this funny microwave noise, essentially, in a radio antenna that the astronomers originally thought was down to pigeons living in their instrument. And it was basically this kind of dogged pursuit of trying to figure out what the hell is this strange noise that led them to the realization, well, the discovery of the proof that the universe had a beginning. And you don't get more profound than that, I don't think.
It's the biggest discovery, as you said, of the 20th century. When there is an anomaly in the data stream, as you say in 188, you could say, one, the result is a statistical fluke. Two, the experimenters made a mistake, which is an unfortunate problem. Three, the theorists got their sums wrong. That happens. And then finally, four, you've discovered something. Have a biscuit.
Exactly. I mean, I think with any of these sorts of anomalies, the most likely explanation is usually something mundane. So, you know, you made a mistake in your experiment, the theorist made a calculation error, or it's just a random statistical fluke. It's like these sort of freak events that just happen by dumb luck sometimes. And you can only really be sure that you're really seeing something new when you eliminate all three of these boring possibilities. And one of the things in the book is, I mean, looking at these five big anomalies that have been around for about 10 years or so, each of them at least, in physics and cosmology. But they're all in the state still where we don't quite know that we can fully eliminate all three of those boring explanations. So that's what makes them simultaneously very tantalizing, but also frustrating that they've not yet turned into big discoveries. So the job of scientists when they're working on these things is really, how do we eliminate all the possible other sources of error and then be able to conclude confidently that we're really seeing something new?
And that's really difficult. As a matter of fact, it's difficult in your personal story that's in this book, which is amazing, which I think sort of forms the center of this book. Before we move on to that, there's a critical statistical threshold known as the 5 sigma that you use throughout the book. Explain what that is and what that means.
Yeah, so 5 sigma is this kind of golden sort of standard that we all aspire to in physics in order to claim a discovery. Basically, what it means is that if you have, say, you have a prediction from your theory of the universe, that could be your theory of particles or the cosmos, that predicts some number that you're trying to measure, and then you measure the number, if your result is more than 5 units of uncertainty, so basically what that means is, you know, if you measure something, it always comes with this uncertainty, which is some numerical expression of how precisely you think you've measured that quantity. When your experiment and your theory are more than 5 uncertainties apart, then that's the kind of gold standard for claiming, okay, at that point, we can say that this is a bona fide discovery. And the reason for this threshold is it's a little bit arbitrary, but basically statistically, when you're five sigma away, that basically means there's less than a 1 in 3.5 million chance of that being a fluke. So it basically eliminates the fluke possibility. And it, and if you've done your, you know, systematic checks properly, it should also eliminate the possibility of like a theory error or some systematic bias. So that's the kind of target we're all gunning for. And actually, some of the anomalies in the book have reached that five sigma threshold, but the doubt is really around, okay, do we really trust this uncertainty that we've calculated?
Wow.
Is that right? Could it actually be bigger than we think? But that's what everyone's aiming for.
Oh, and that's what what's great about your personal story in this, because you really bring people along that process. And it just sounds like I would be pulling my hair out at every single moment as that was going on, because it was just so tense. And you had to be extra, extra, extra sure. And we won't give away the end of the story yet, but let's talk about it. You work at the Large Hadron Collider, and for people who may not know what that is, can you explain what it is and how freaking huge it is?
Yeah, so the LHC, Large Hadron Collider, is a gigantic particle collider, so a huge ring, essentially, buried underground outside Geneva and on the Swiss-French border. So it's about 100 meters below the surface. It's 27 kilometers in circumference. That's about 19 miles or so. It's the biggest scientific instrument that's ever been built in human history. I mean, by some measures, it's the biggest machine in the world as well. Depends how you measure it. And essentially what it does is it accelerates subatomic particles called protons around the ring to very high speeds until they're going at a whisker below the speed of light. And then they're smashed into each other inside big detectors. And I work on one of these big detectors. And basically my job and my colleague's job is to analyze the data that we get from these collisions. And what we're looking for essentially are new particles, new fundamental particles being created in the collisions, or possibly particles that we already know about that are misbehaving, that are behaving in ways that we can't explain with our current theories. That's a very big picture of what we're up to there.
And it, your particular experiment is called the LHC small b.
Yeah, that's right.
And what you're looking for, ultimately, all the scientists there, is something that's going to sort of deflect or be separate from or not obey the standard model, or could possibly add on to the standard model. And the amazing thing for me is how many collisions occur at the LHC every second. How many collisions are happening? Like some ridiculous number, like a million?
Yeah.
A million?
It's nuts. So there are 40 million collisions. Well, actually, there's more than that. But basically what happens is you have what we call events, 40 million times every second inside each of the detectors. And those events can each contain between one or even 100 individual proton-proton collisions. So you're talking hundreds of millions of collisions per second around the whole ring, basically. And that's happening 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for about 9 months of the year. So if you kind of multiply those numbers together, you can imagine this is, you know, the number of collisions in a year is vast. And we've been running for about 10 years now. So we've got a huge amount of data. And the reason we have such high collision rates is basically we're looking for really, really rare signals. So most of the time when you bash two protons together, you just get stuff you've already seen before, sort of particles we already know about. And it's only in a tiny handful that something intriguing happens. So the sort of the big challenge is basically sifting through this vast ocean of data in search of the little sort of flecks of gold which you're actually after that could tell you something new.
What you're looking for specifically, we don't have time to explain all this. You do a really good job in the book. I just want to let people who are listening know that they should read the book to fully understand what we're talking about. But you're looking for the the change of a beauty quark to a strange quark. How often does that happen?
Very rarely. So we're looking at these really, really rare processes. So a beauty quark is a fundamental particle. They get created in large numbers at the collider. And we're looking for very rare decays of these things. So when these particles basically transform into other particles. And we're looking for these events that happen one in a million times. So if you have a million beauty quarks, you'll get like one of these decays.
Jesus.
And the reason these things are interesting is basically they can be affected. The way they behave, these decays, can be affected by new forces of nature, new particles that we've not seen before. And that's because we basically have these really big problems in physics. You know, we know, for example, one of the biggest mysteries is that 95% of the universe is made of this invisible stuff called dark matter and dark energy.
Mm.
And we have no idea what it is. And so one of the reasons we do these experiments is to try to find new fundamental ingredients of the universe that could explain the strange results we're getting from astronomy. So, and one of the ways of doing this is to make these very precise measurements of these very rare processes and compare them to your theory. And if you see a difference, that can be the clue to the existence of something new that could help you address some of these big questions.
Now, when the beauty quark decays to a strange quark or changes to a strange quark, it's a strange quark and typically two muons.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're looking for something else to happen.
Yeah, that's right. So basically, I mean, one of the sets of anomalies that I was working on was this transformation from a beauty quark into a strange quark and two muons. Apologies for all the jargon, but a muon is like essentially it's like an electron, which is a thing you find in an atom, but it's a bit heavier. And you can compare that process to a beauty quark turning into a strange quark and two electrons. And the basic idea is that muons and electrons in this theory that we have of particle physics are pretty much identical, except they have different masses. And that means that the forces pull on them with the same strength. And that means these two decays where you switch electrons from muons should happen at the same rate in our current theory. But for many years, what we were seeing were these anomalies where the electron decay was happening more often than the muon decay.
Yeah, yeah.
And that may sound kind of a bit prosaic, but it was really exciting because there is no way to explain that result given what we know about the universe at the fundamental level. So if it was a real effect, it was, you know, guaranteed evidence of a new force, which was, you know, which would be massive.
Why are people expecting that there are going to be changes or corrections or extensions of the standard model? It's called the standard model. It seems like it would work, but there are so many questions about the standard model.
Yeah, I mean, the standard model is an amazing thing in many. It's got a really boring name. It makes it sound like it's a bit dull and sort of pedestrian, but I think I say this several times in the book. I think it's one of the greatest intellectual achievements of human beings. It's this incredibly elegant mathematical description of pretty much everything we know about the universe at the fundamental level, except for gravity. And it agrees with pretty much every experiment we've ever done on Earth. So it's fantastically successful. But we know that it's also incomplete, that it's got some really big holes in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of these is, you know, I talked about dark matter already. It can't explain what dark matter is, which makes up five times more of the universe than the ordinary stuff we're made of. It doesn't include gravity. It also makes these weird predictions. Basically, the standard model predicts that we should not exist, that the universe in its current form should not be possible. And any theory that predicts the non-existence of its own authors is probably in trouble. So these are reasons for thinking there's more out there. And so what we're trying to do really is to break the standard model. We're trying to find those places where this theory breaks down, and that will give us the clue to what comes next, what bigger theory takes over afterwards.
Now, what was the first hint that you might have been onto something?
Well, the first hint came back, it was way back in 2013, and we were measuring these processes with these beauty quarks, and we saw that essentially the first thing we saw was that the angles that the particles were coming out at from the decay were different to what the standard model predicts. The standard model predicts quite a lot of detail of these processes, and it was a little subtle effect. Then we started to see evidence that this electron decay that we were looking at was happening more often than the muon decay, which again you can't explain. And more of these anomalies started to accumulate over the years, basically. And so it became, for a while, the sort of real hot topic in particle physics, particularly in the context of the LHC. We'd had years and years of looking for new particles and hadn't found any, despite lots of optimism back in the early 2010s that we would. And this really became one of the best hopes for seeing something new. So this evidence accumulated. I got into the area and started making my own measurements. In 2021, this big result came out, which confirmed the anomalies with even greater strength.
Uh-oh.
And then my own result came out. So it was a very exciting time where we were really, it felt like everything was pointing towards us being on the brink of a massive breakthrough.
This is one of those things where it's really, really exciting and really, really scary.
at this point.
Now, there are many problems. First of all, analyzing data is really particularly problematic in the case of electrons. As you write, I think electrons are a pain in the ass.
that's pretty much right. They are a pain in the ass. I mean, basically, electrons, so you have to imagine this massive particle detector that's the size of an office building, like 20 meters long, 15 meters high, and these particles are created inside it and they fly through it. And electrons, they're very light. And because they're very light, they basically get knocked about as they travel through the detector by ordinary atoms in the material. And that means that they like radiate away their energy, and they're very difficult to kind of reconstruct accurately in your detector. So they're just basically kind of hard things to study accurately. And so when you're studying electrons, you have to be really, really careful to convince yourself you're, you know, measuring their momentum and their energies right, and all this sort of stuff. And you get anything wrong, you can bias yourself and make you think that you're seeing some evidence of a new force, when actually it's just you don't understand how particles behave in your detector. So that's, and you know, when you're potentially on the brink of some major discovery, it's obviously exhilarating, but at the same time, as you say, it's terrifying, because the worst thing you can do as an experimental physicist is, you know, really, you know, mess things up and claim you're seeing something new, when actually it's just that you've made an error in your measurement.
So, and you write about this in great detail in this book, about what's going through your mind and the other people that you're working with. So at what point did you say, maybe we should start to present some papers or tell other people about this?
Well, I mean, the paper's coming out actually from about 2013. So I think there was one in 2013, 14, 2017. So the evidence is basically building over time. And in the meantime, we were collecting more data, more collisions. So we're kind of reanalyzing that data and getting the measurements more and more precise. So the kind of the big moment, I suppose, was in 2021, when some of my colleagues presented a measurement of this, comparing electrons and muons with the whole data set that we had at the time.
Oh,
and this
wow.
came out above the what we call the 3 sigma threshold. So we're not 5 sigma, we're at 3 sigma. And rather arbitrarily, 3 sigma is the point at which we say we have evidence of something.
Got it.
Like,
I guess in a
forensic investigation, you found the murder weapon, but you haven't proven who the killer was, something like that. But that kind of meant that result got a lot of attention, and there was reports on it in, newspapers all over the world, on TV.
Oh, my God.
So it was a really big deal.
I mean, you're talking about a potential revolution in particle physics that you're about to usher in. And then people start postulating theories to include this data, like, is the Standard Model just a low-energy echo of a far more symmetrical theory that lives at very high energies? I mean, all that stuff is starting to come out. And to your credit, in this book, you really detail the unraveling. And my heart went out to you in the book. I've never had a reaction like this in a physics book before, but my heart really went out to you, and I really felt. So what was the first hints that maybe this isn't it?
Well, it was kind of fortuitous, really. So what happened was, this measurement came out. My measurement came out as well. So I worked with a student at Cambridge on a similar measurement that all seemed to back up what the original measurement said. So it was looking really, really compelling. And then a few months later, another team within our experiment were reanalyzing the same data, basically, for another paper that they were producing. And when they got the result, they got a different answer to
Oops.
The paper from earlier that year.
Oops.
And they were analyzing the same data. So this was like, okay, how do you get a different result with the same data? And in the process of drilling into this, we started to discover evidence that there was something wrong, basically. And they had basically used slightly different analysis techniques, which meant that they were seeing a different size of effect to us. And long story short, what we eventually found was that there was a background. So this is like another kind of decay, a different type of decay that didn't involve electrons, where we were misidentifying some other types of particles as electrons, basically. So if you imagine you're counting electrons and you're counting muons, if you have some fake electrons in your sample, that will cause you to overestimate the number of electrons,
oh,
and
God.
It creates an anomaly. So it was a very difficult period of time. Everyone was working very intensely trying to figure out, you know, what on earth is going on here. And there were moments where we thought, oh, actually, it's fine, everything's okay. And then other moments where you're like, oh God, you know, this is really, really bad. And in the end, actually, we realized that, you know, our measurements were contaminated. So after several months, the new result was released, where we basically had to admit to the global community, look, this thing we thought was an anomaly, actually, it was a mistake in our experiment. And when we corrected it, everything agreed beautifully with the Standard Model. So it was, you go from sort of like euphoria to absolute horror and sort of and depression.
It has to be gut-wrenching. And first of all, so much work. So much work. And then the euphoria of coming up with potentially a revolution and then having the balloon popped. But what was fascinating in the book is that you went to a number of different people and talked to them about dealing with failure in interpreting data. And Mitesh Patel, whenever you're working at the limit of knowledge, you run the risks of making mistakes, but errors can be the greatest training of all. And that sort of seemed to be the sentiment of all the other scientists.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true. And it's something that I've sort of found throughout my career, actually. When you make a mistake, it's the best teacher. I mean, you really learn. And I think one of the most important qualities of any scientist, particularly an experimental scientist, is skepticism and caution. And that's no more true than when it comes to your own work. You really have to begin with doubt, and it's only when you convince yourself that you can really claim, you know, you've made some discovery. And I think that was a really good lesson for me, but also for the field. And it taught us a lot about, it's interesting, even though this particular anomaly went away, it generated theoretical ideas that are actually, that had never been considered before,
right,
and people
right.
are still working on because they're exciting. It taught us a lot about how our experiments work and will allow us to make more precise measurements in the future. So, I mean, that's in general about anomalies. Even when anomalies don't turn out to be the clue to some major breakthrough, they often teach you something, and they sort of sharpen your scientific tools so that when you come to the next measurement or the next attempt at a discovery, you're in a much better position than you were before. So they're always interesting, whether or not they go somewhere really profound in the end.
Also, this is a great book for how contemporary science works, at least in cosmological or particle physics. One of the most interesting things you wrote is how your collaborators are often also your competitors.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that? Because I don't know if any other business is like that.
Yeah, particle physics particularly is a strange thing where we work on these experiments that have thousands of people on them sometimes. So my experiment's about 1,400 of us. And you are collaborating. So you work together, all these universities around the world, building the experiment, operating it, analyzing the data. But you're also independent researchers, and what you're trying to get is, you know, you're trying to get a highly cited publication or some piece of research that has a big impact. And so, but there's only a finite number of interesting measurements you can make, really. And so there's competition to sort of stake out an area. So you say, I'm making this particular measurement. So and people say, well, I want to make that as well. And then you have to sort of compete / collaborate to kind of find a way of working together. So it's this funny tension where you are all kind of on the same side to an extent, but at the same time, you're not. I mean, maybe it's a bit like being on a kind of sports team where you're all on the same team, but you're also competing to get on the starting lineup and not be on the substitute bench. It's a little bit like that, I think.
Does that mean there's all sorts of intrigue, like you hide data from other people, or you can't do that in science?
Well, I mean, the data is accessible to anyone, but you might not necessarily reveal exactly what you're doing with it straight away, because that might be a bit strategic. If there's a really interesting thing you've identified that no one else has thought of, you probably want to make some progress along that line before you let everyone know you're doing it, to stop other people kind of, you know, piling on the bandwagon kind of thing. So, yeah, there's these funny sort of games that get played. But, I mean, broadly speaking, we're all on the same team. We're all trying to, you know, find out something new about the world. And ultimately, that comes first. But obviously, people do want to be the ones that have their name on the discovery if and when you make one.
Now, we only have a few minutes left. And the great thing about this book is it goes from the very, very large, the universe, to the extremely small quarks and their decays. I just want to just talk generally about one of the subjects in the book is about the problem with the Hubble constant. Can you just address that one and why that's important?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating story. Basically, there is this big crisis in cosmology at the moment, or people are calling it a crisis, over how fast the universe is expanding. So we've known for almost 100 years now that space itself is getting bigger. It's growing. The space between galaxies is increasing. And there are two different ways of getting at this expansion rate. One, basically, is you look at stuff you can see in the sky, like distant galaxies, and it, through a series of very clever techniques, you measure how far away those galaxies are, and you measure their speed. And if you compare these two things, you then get the expansion rate, essentially, of the universe. The other way is you look at the light from the Big Bang, so this radiation I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, which is basically information on how the universe was in its very earliest moment. So about 400,000 years after the universe began, which is, you know, 13.8 billion years ago. So a very long period in the past. And then from that information, you can basically run the clock forward and predict the expansion rate today, what it ought to be. And for about 10 years, these two numbers haven't lined up. So the prediction doesn't agree, basically, with the measurement. And there has been a very fierce debate over what exactly is causing this. The exciting option is that there is essentially some new form of force or energy, or perhaps we don't understand gravity properly, that is essentially changing the history of the universe and means that our standard cosmological model is wrong or incomplete in some way. That's the kind of exciting option. The other option is there is some mistake in the way that we calibrate distances to galaxies or so and so on that could have basically biased one of these results. And there is this really, I think, quite fierce debate in cosmology between different teams who have different methods of measuring these things that don't agree with each other. So it's kind of fascinating watching this as an outsider, not being in the field, as to how this gets resolved. Because, you know, if it's real, it's going to be, you know, a really major discovery. And it could also have implications for particle physics as well. If there's some new force out there, that maybe is something that we can look for on an experiment. So it's exciting, but again, inconclusive at the moment. And actually, just this last week, a new result came out that seemed to be challenging whether this anomaly was real or not. So it's an evolving story. We'll have to see where it goes.
Aren't some people postulating that it could be multi-component dark matter?
Yes. So they're all
that idea sounds wild.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that wild, really, when you think about it. I mean, so
well,
the classic idea of dark matter is, well, I mean, if you think about, we are, our universe, so this visible universe, it makes up 5% of everything that we think is out there. And our universe is incredibly rich. Like, there are loads of different particles. We have all these interesting structures, you know, planets, stars, galaxies, human beings. And the dark matter, there's five times more dark matter than there is of other stuff we're made from.
And we don't even know what that is.
No, we know, we have no idea what it is, and we tend to assume that it's just one boring particle that just floats about in space. But that is kind of a bit, I don't know, chauvinistic in a way towards dark matter to just think, well, why should this stuff that's five times more abundant than us be so boring? I mean, it could have, there's no reason there can't be dark structures, you know, so more complicated physics, basically, which would give rise to maybe much more interesting dark sectors than the one we generally assume. And so, you know, yeah, indeed, this anomaly could be a clue to something telling us that basically dark matter is more complicated and interesting than we've assumed so far.
We're out of time. People are going to need to read the book to fill in all the background of all the stuff. And you did a great job of it. My guest tonight is Harry Cliff, particle physicist based at the University of Cambridge and carries out research at the LHCb experiment at CERN's Large Hadron Collider. And the book we've been talking about, and it's really good and really interesting to read, Space Oddities: The Mysterious Anomalies Challenging Our Understanding of the Universe. Harry, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.